Welcome to the Aftershock Central Podcast. We do not have a full Voltron today. It's just Travis and myself. That's all we need. We don't need Ronnie. Who's Ronnie? Screw that guy. He ditched us. We rescheduled today, and where is he?
I don't know, man. I feel like he might have been on board for Wednesday, but we didn't get it together, so.
Yeah.
You know, well, what's important is we're here now.
Well, we are here now. I think he had a baseball game tonight.
Extra innings.
Yeah, yeah. So it's possible that there is an excuse that is acceptable. However, I don't think so, because we are here to do the Lord's work, and he's not. All right, yes, let's talk about some books.
That is why we are here.
We are here for stuff. Lord stuff. Ha-ha! We have gathered here tonight, Travis, to discuss three Aftershock titles. I don't think there's any news, right? There's no news. I don't know. Ronnie's a news guy. He's not here. So we're lost. No, there's no news. But we're here to talk about three books tonight.
No news is good news.
New news is good news. I think Joe's a little busy touring. I think he's heading down to Florida for a signing with Paul Jenkins. We've got three books to talk about. We're going to talk about Brothers Dracul number 5, the final issue. We're going to talk about A Walk Through Hell number 4, and a brand new book, The Beyonders number 1. So let's just go in that order. How about that?
Yeah.
First up on the docket is Brothers Dracul number 5. Final issue, like I said, written by Cullen Bunn, art by Mirko Kolak. Let's get into it. Let's get into it. How did you feel about this final issue of this book? Well, we'll say supposedly final issue, because it ends with an end question mark.
I see. Interesting. I feel like maybe it feels a little bit rushed in a few senses, you know, like trying to get it to, like, where it is that, you know, it kind of, like obviously the summation, if I understand it correctly, is like, you know, basically they're pointing to a falling out between the brothers. And that's because, you know, Radu went to kill Ermine Vampire Lady.
Yep.
Vlad intercedes, stops him, and he's like, I saved you, you know? So that confused me, like, what about that situation, you know, makes Vlad claim he's saving Radu, and he's like, go away, but then he doesn't kill Ermine. And I, you know, that seems to be like kind of hazily resolved. Like, Vlad just walks away from that, and it's like, yep, well, you know, I guess, you know, maybe I did what I said I did. And then at some point becomes like the ruler of Transylvania or whatever, right?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, he does kind of save Radu, right? Because when Ermine shows up and they're killing all the vampires, they kill the head vampire guy that looks like a older, non-bearded, non-mustached Vlad. They kill that guy. And then some of the other, the Ottomans get killed as well. Presumably, I think we could assume by Vlad. And Ermine's like, oh, like, you're the one that we've been looking for. And I guess he gets knocked out, or maybe that's when he disappears to kill everybody else, and Radu shows up. And she's like, well, we wanted your brother, but you'll do. And that's when he saves Radu. So, I mean, he does save him from whatever fate. I think the problem is we don't know what that fate is, right? I think that's a little bit part of the confusion for me. Where I would have maybe liked another issue explaining exactly what happened here. Because I think there's a lot more questions than answers in this final issue.
Sure. Like, I mean, picking up from the previous issue, right, you know, this, I think, felt like it was all somehow like a ruse to get Vlad, to draw Vlad out, you know, because he's the target. Like, Ermine's not the target. It's like, we want Vlad. But if I understand this correctly, Vlad seems like he's human. And, you know, like seems like Ermine is the one maybe who is actually causing all the mayhem in and around the castle.
You mean in the quote-unquote present?
Yes.
Okay. Interesting. I didn't get that. How'd you come to that conclusion?
I don't know. I felt like there was some kind of line about, like, and he thinks you're the monster, like, you, Vlad, are the monster, when really it's me. But, I mean, I'm also confused, I guess, by, you know, all Vlad's comments about, like, I was killing vampires, you know, and Radu is saying, no, those were just people. And then at the end of the issue, there's like a thing where he's like, you know, I can't see innocent people anymore. And he's looking at Radu and somebody else in panel, and he sees them as monsters.
Yeah, I actually really liked that part, and I didn't know what to think about it. Because I don't know if it shows Vlad's state of mind, based on the fact that he's killed so many people, maybe he's just kind of gone crazy. Or has everyone kind of been corrupted by Ermine in this area, aside from Vlad? I mean, I think the first option seems the most logical, right? That he's just kind of gone crazy.
Tough to say, yeah. Yeah, more logical, sure. But there's obviously, like, magical stuff going on here and there as well. So he could be Enthrall or something.
Did you find it curious that all the guys that are accompanying Radu into the throne room don't have faces?
Yeah.
Like, even when you have close-ups of them, they don't have a face. And I thought that was interesting. I don't know if it was meant to say that, I mean, partially they don't matter, but, I mean, if you're doing such a close-up of some of these guys, why not put a face there, right? Even if they're hooded. So I wonder if maybe the vampires didn't end up winning. Maybe these guys are actually vampires.
Huh.
And the only reason that Vlad is still there is because he's the only one that knows that there are still vampires around, and he's kind of the only one that can keep the truce, right? Because now that their original leader, right, the long-haired guy that was killed in the flashback scene, now that he's gone, Vlad has taken over the role of being the leader, and he made some kind of truce because there was no way that three little kids would end up killing a whole tribe of vampires, right? So he made this truce where, like, okay, I'll be your leader, and, you know, I'll allow you to feed on these people, but at the same time, I'm going to keep Ermine in check because she's got obviously some kind of power over them, right? She's possessed by a vampire. They even say it in there, like, you know, Ermine is not the vampire. The vampire's inside her. It's in her blood. So I wonder if that's not ultimately what happened, is that there's some kind of truce that was forged where they're allowed to kill people to an extent, and Vlad's the only one that can actually control them.
That's super interesting, dude. I feel like if that's there, that's almost entirely off panel, you know? So, like, yeah, maybe another issue might have been kind of nice to flesh that out a little bit.
Well, and I think that may explain a few things, right? Like, for one, the fact that he's still killing so many people. Two, the no-face guys. Three, the fact that he states over and over that he saved Radu and Radu doesn't understand. Like, maybe he's taken the burden upon himself to kind of continue this journey of stopping the vampires. And that may ultimately not be the way that they intended it, but it's what works best in this world.
I like it.
Just a thought.
Yeah, that's great, dude. Let me ask you this. You know, did you notice that Ermine at the end seemed to have, like, broken manacles on her wrists?
Yeah, a little bit.
So, like, that would imply that she was, you know, chained up at some point?
Well, yes, but I don't think she's allowed to leave this cell that she's in, right? I mean, you see the rubble and stuff behind her. Yeah, he's in her cell.
Hmm.
No? Because, okay. I mean, he opens the door to get in there.
Okay.
But I do wonder if maybe, I don't know if she's got enough room to escape, because you see the rubble behind her, and there's puddles of water, so you assume that water's somehow getting in there, so maybe there's a hole large enough for her to escape.
Hmm.
Unless she's maybe she's chained directly to the ground, and that's why you don't see the rest of the chains on her manacles.
Yeah, I mean, I thought, looking at it, that, like, she had broken loose, you know, either recently or, you know, at an earlier date, and, you know, I just thought she was running free or whatever. Like, at some point she was chained up, but no more.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you think it is that that she taught him?
Yeah, I was going to ask you. I don't know.
Hmm.
She taught him something.
Yeah, she taught him something.
He's afraid to tell Radu, right?
Yep. But what that something is, we don't know. And I do wonder if some of her power is kind of gone also, because you see the crucifix on her forehead. I don't remember that being there in the flashback scenes. So maybe at some point they did, like, an exorcism on her or whatever, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah. There's definitely, you know, kind of a bunch of questions. I'll agree with that statement from earlier that, you know, there's definitely a lot of questions that are left hanging.
Yeah, I think I'm going to shoot Cullen a message and see if he's got a couple of things to say about this to clear things up a little bit. Maybe we'll have to revisit it on the next episode.
Yeah, I mean, I like the art a lot. And, you know, I think it's kind of an interesting premise for a story. So I would say I liked it overall.
All right, well, let's get to the ratings then.
All right, I'll go 4 out of 5.
I will also go 4 out of 5. I think regardless of the fact that I don't think we get an actual conclusion. I think it was quite a good book, quite a good final issue. All right, let's go to the next book. A Walk Through Hell, number 4, written by Garth Ennis, with art by Goren Suzuka. And this one actually, surprisingly, even though the story I think was more straightforward than the previous 3 issues, it left me the most confused.
Yeah.
I would say the majority of this issue, I mean, there's very few panels in the present at the warehouse, but the majority of the issue takes place, in the past, in flashback scenes, as they're doing their investigative duties in finding the serial killer, who they assume is the guy that owns all the rental properties where the kids are getting killed. Makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. So do you mind if I run through, like, what I think is the timeline, like chronological timeline?
Yeah, yeah,
and you tell me if it sounds right, because I was confused as well. It's a lot of that like time jumping, but it's not in order as far as I can tell.
Yep.
So like I feel like you start out with, you know, the interrogation, which is not going well. They're not getting what they wanted. I feel like as that's happening, they've already planted like a body in one of the dude's properties. And they were, I guess, counting on, you know, breaking the suspect and getting a confession so that they could, you know, get a warrant for the property. Or I'm a little fuzzy on that, like why they were so desperate for that to go well, or if basically failing on that was why they planted the stuff. But anyway, seems like, you know, after they plan it, whatever, like the next day they show up and they're searching the property, and that's when they find like Kitty Torso outside.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a scene kind of indeterminate amount later where they're like having drinks and they're talking about basically like it's all gone to hell and they need to shut down the investigation. You know, they're talking about, like, you know, a traumatic thing that has happened to Shaw, and seems like maybe the traumatic experience happened just prior to that, like when she went to the dude's house or whatever. So I think that's kind of the sequence of events, all of that.
Yeah, I think that makes sense to me. I think it's pretty obvious from this issue that, it's not obvious that the guy, what's his name, Callahan, right?
Yeah.
Or Carnahan. I don't know if it's necessarily obvious that Carnahan is the serial killer. I think there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that places this guy at the center of the whole thing. And these two, for whatever reason, in particular Shaw, I would say, I don't know if McGregor necessarily is entirely convinced that he's the killer. But Shaw seems to be very adamant that he is. And I think you're right. I think the scene in the interrogation room happens before anything else. And they do go to search the property, because they have to release the guy, right? They have only a certain amount of time where they can hold him without having any evidence for whatever crime he committed. So they need to find that evidence before they legally have to let him go from prison. And so that's why they get the warrant to search the property, in which they find nothing until Shaw finds the coat hanging from the hook and there's a torso inside it. So somebody planted the evidence there, but who is that somebody? Because it seems like they were all surprised that it was there because nobody had seen it before. Shaw is the one that finds it, and Shaw seems to be the one that's most adamant about this guy being the killer. The problem is, we don't know why she's so adamant about that being the case, right? Because we know she suffers some kind of trauma, but we don't know what the trauma is. We, I think, have to assume that it's somehow connected to Carnahan, or somebody like Carnahan that she's imposing her feelings onto. But do you think she's the one that planted the body? And if so, if she's the one that planted the body, I'm starting to wonder if maybe she's not involved in the killings.
I definitely agree that Shaw seems suspicious beyond what we already know about, you know, her dirty cop antics, you know. As far as who did what, I feel like I got the impression, based on the dialogue, that, like, she had the idea and the partner, like, schlepped the body into the basement or whatever, you know. And just to clarify, like, that was at the same property, right, that that they found the torso at. You know, like, they planted something under the floorboards.
Right.
And when they, like, had to go check that out, then, like, there's this other thing that they didn't know about. Okay, also, I totally agree that I think there's maybe more than meets the eye with Callahan, because... Yes. I feel like a pretty weird thing in the interview scene, especially where, you know, he almost kind of like flips a switch. And when it comes around to, like, you've been involved in all these kitty murders or something, he's like, what are you talking about? And he seems horrified. And that's, you know, like, it's kind of weird to put that in if, you know, he is your kind of, like, creepy serial killer character. He could as easily be, you know, like, also, like, under control, the same as the dude who ate his own arm. And I got a weird vibe in that interrogation scene from the lawyer, you know? Like, my crazy theory would be that, like, the real, like, devil-type character or whatever in all this is the lawyer, and that's in the, like, defending the Callahan.
I think we thought the same thing with the previous issue, right? The lawyer seemed like the one that was really off, and not so much Carnahan. So I definitely agree with that. Something is wrong there. But I'm still not convinced, because there's, you know, every issue we're getting some kind of weird left turn on the actual narrative of what's happening, right? Because if you think about it, when we first started reading this book in the first issue, I don't think there was any hint whatsoever that Sean McGregor would go plant evidence against this one guy, right? Like, it seemed pretty cut and dry. And now in this issue, I don't think that's necessarily the case. And like I said, in particular with Shaw, like, Shaw seems really off. She even talks about how she hates kids and, like, the reason why she hates them. Cause, like, if you go to a party, people start talking about their kids, how their kids are perfect, this, that, and the other. And you know, we saw a flashback in a previous issue where we discuss whether there was maybe a rape or, you know, maybe an aborted child or something like that. So there's definitely, like, circumstantial evidence to plant on Shaw just as much as you have in Carnahan. I mean, really all we have in Carnahan is he owns these properties and that's about it.
Well, also he was fingered by, no pun intended, the like other guy who's being interrogated, right?
Right.
The dude who
ate his hand,
who then killed himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, he was like, Callahan's the dude, you know, I'm telling you that. And, you know, I seems like he's maybe not reliable. If, you know, taken in full context.
Yeah, no, I don't think we can, use that as an honest statement. For one, people are known to lie when being interrogated, just because usually they tell the interrogator pretty much whatever they want to hear, so they quit being interrogated. So we do know that that actually happens in real life. So I don't know if we can assume that. And if McGregor and Shaw are already set on Carnahan being the killer, then this guy picked up on that, and that's what he told him. So I don't think his testimony means anything in the overall part of the story.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know that they had his name and stuff before that interview, but I certainly could be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on how the timeline flows. Because, I mean, when after he's interrogated, the first time you see Carnahan is when he's already in jail. he's got the orange jumpsuit on, right? They don't bring him in to interrogate him. And I think that would be the procedure.
Yeah, I mean, you don't put somebody in the jumpsuit, like, if they're just there to answer questions.
Right, exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know. I definitely speaks to that the way they kind of are putting together all the timelines is a little bit tough to keep straight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I think it's interesting. Oh, other thing that occurs to me, by the way, since now we're looking at Shaw as like maybe a serial killer type, is mm-hmm. we're seeing her now hearing voices in the warehouse, right?
Yeah, but didn't we see that before? I think in the first issue when we had the flashback scene of her in the bed, wasn't she hearing voices then too?
I think maybe you're right. Yeah. So maybe, I don't know, like that's interesting, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
kind of points to either a possession or like a mental illness or something.
Yeah. I'm going to go, less possession. I think part of what I like about this book so much is that I don't feel like even the really bizarre, outrageous stuff, like, you know, we had that one, was it issue two, I guess, when the guy kept on shooting himself in the head over and over again. I think even that stuff is not so much mystical or magical or whatever. I think it's more psychological. And I wonder how much of the stuff in the warehouse is not more of like an internal manifestation of Shaw's dealing with the situation than anything else. Like, I'm starting to really be curious of whether that's the case, right? Whether the warehouse is actually a thing.
Hmm. You think it's all in her head or something?
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. Could be. I mean, it's there's a lot of intrigue for sure.
Yep. Interesting. So, I'm looking forward to the next issue, though, because I guess we're going to learn when she, if I read this correctly, when she confronted Carnahan the first time. So, maybe when we get that confrontation, we're going to get a little more information on what the actual timeline of events is.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's enough on its face to seem like there's something supernatural going on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like I don't know if the POV is so specific to Shaw that it might all just be her own, you know, kind of hallucinations or psychosis. I don't know. I'm taking it at face value in that way, but I don't really know how all of it ties into the larger story about, you know, hunt for like a child killer. I guess if it is Shaw, then that does wrap it up pretty cleanly.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You got to think too, when they're interrogating Carnahan, like at no point does he try to own up to anything that he's done. And one thing about serial killers is once they're caught, they just start spewing out every single thing that they've done in very graphic detail. Because part of the thing when they get caught is they want to get full credit for everything they've done, and he's taking zero credit for anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange that he seems so confused about what they're even talking about.
Yep.
They frame it as being a long interrogation, but right at the end of it, it comes out that they're talking about, you know, child murders, and he seems to be surprised. So I don't know what they were talking about in all that time, just about rental properties, or did you know this guy, or I don't know.
Yep. All right, let's rate this one up. I'm going to go ahead and go first and give this a 5 out of 5.
Nice.
Yeah.
This book's
a journey, dude. You know what I'm saying? It's not easy to read, and I think that's what's intriguing to me the most.
Yeah, for sure, dude. I mean, it's definitely a challenge, especially with the way that they work with the multiple timelines and the way that they've kind of like withheld facts and like unfolded the stuff over time. And then you work in your kind of unreliable stuff about what is real and what's not, you know, and is anybody crazy? So, you know, there's a lot to balance there. I'll go 4.5 out of 5.
Cool.
I like it.
All right. Let's get to the final book of the week. And that is Beyonders #1, written by Paul Jenkins with art by Wes St. Clair. Which, by the way, I'm super happy to have Wes Sinclair back in a book. He did the Fujitsu book, which I think we really enjoyed, and it was very out there.
Yeah.
This one's not so much out there. Well, I mean, there's a lot of out there things, but it's not as insane as Fujitsu was. Not yet, at least.
Yeah, it's only just starting, though.
Yeah, just, well, but I mean, Fujitsu kind of started off kind of weird, right? This one, not so much. Sure. I mean, you have a lot of conspiracy theories and stuff like that in this book, but I think for the most part, it's very straightforward.
But we got robots, and we got, I'm going to say, time travel?
Yeah.
I don't know, like
maybe aliens?
Maybe aliens. Yeah, maybe all of that. Like, what happens right at the end, right? They're like, come with me if you want to live. Where's she coming from? Is it not
the beyond?
Okay.
I want to talk about the first couple of pages of this because I think this is one of my most favorite setups of any first issue that I've read maybe this year. Definitely this month for sure. I really enjoy this. Number one, I love conspiracy theories. I don't believe most of them, but I love reading about them because what's really fascinating about conspiracy theories is how people's minds work to try to find meaning in the most meaningless things. And I think that's kind of a central point of this book, right? Because this kid, Jake, his life, let's be real, kind of sucks, right? He lives in the middle of nowhere in Alaska. He's about to graduate from high school. He wants to go to MIT and wherever else. No school accepted him. So basically, like, the school counselor is like, yeah, that's fine, but you didn't get accepted to any school, so you should go work on the fishing boat. And, I mean, obviously this kid is very smart, right? He can make these connections to all these different events. And so there's kind of two things going on at once. And then kind of the S hits the fan towards the end of the book, and we'll get to that in a second. But I really love the first few pages because it makes a lot of connections. This is Jake talking, by the way, when you're getting all these different connections. It makes different connections between different events and how these things are not necessarily separate things. They're all somehow connected. And he's trying to find how all these things are connected. And going like really far back, right? Because I think when he's looking at his board and he's talking to his uncle, he tells him, he's like, I'm attempting to travel back to the time of 1492 using the power of concentration, right? So he's trying to connect all these events for the past like 500 plus years just by analyzing the information that he's got. And I thought that was really interesting.
Well, yeah, dude, I mean, like just to that point, I feel like there's stuff within those pages that kind of implies either like travel through time or people that live unnaturally long lives, you know, like they're talking about a dude from the 1400s passing something on to somebody a century later. And that's tough to do. You know, unless you are time traveling.
It's very possible. Very possible. I mean, obviously there's, like secret society stuff in here that's not explicitly discussed. But we can assume based on other things that we see, right? I mean, like the Beyonders to me seems like a secret society, right? That are kind of in charge of keeping the world secrets.
They call themselves freedom fighters too, which I thought was interesting because that, I think freedom fighters implies that there's some kind of, you know, tyrannical government that they're going against or something, you know, a power that they are fighting for freedom. And yeah, like seems like maybe their, mission statement is maybe tied to whatever message is being passed along through all these historical, personages.
Yep.
Because that's what like, Pigtail says at the end, right? Is like everything is true, you know, basically. And also something that I thought was interesting is, you know, they, not only do they recruit him, but they're like, bring your research, you know, bring your files. So like, he's figuring stuff out that even they hadn't put together yet, you know?
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And what's really interesting too, right, is we get all this setup of how mundane his life is until there's a massive thunderstorm in the area. And I like the way that played out, right? So he's doing like random video chats with girls online, like chat roulette kind of. But he keeps getting cut off because lightning strikes and he loses power. So he like gets back on and talks to somebody else, and that somebody else ends up being important. We see her again at the end of the story. But then, like, there's a massive power surge, and we see that his aunt and uncle, who he lives with, are robots. I mean, this might be kind of spoilery, right? Because I didn't see any mention of that in the solicit for the book. I think it played a lot of on the conspiracy theory stuff, but not so much on the fact that there would be a twist with his family. Because they're watching TV, and all of a sudden, like, they're stuck on a loop. They're repeating the same thing over and over again. Like the fact that, hey, Jake, do you want a sandwich? Right? Because the sandwich thing is kind of a joke throughout the issue. And then we see that the dog is not just a dog either, because the dog's talking to Jake. So is the dog like a robot too, or is the dog like a little alien thing, or whatever? You know what I'm saying? Apparently, by the way, the dog is based on Paul's dog. He had a corgi named whatever this dog's name was. I can't remember now. Shadwell?
Yeah.
Yeah, so apparently Paul Jenkins had a dog named a corgi named Shadwell.
So let me give you my reads on some of this stuff.
Yep.
Okay, so as far as the dog, I felt like I saw a speaker or something on the dog's collar.
Oh, maybe, yeah. So
to me, that implied that, like, maybe somebody was broadcasting and the dog just had a speaker or whatever.
Yeah,
dog
actually,
does seem to be very intelligent.
Yes.
So maybe it's an extra smart dog, like some combination of those two.
Well, no, you're right, because it keeps saying, like, follow the dog, right? It's not like follow me. So yeah, it might be an outside party saying these things. But yeah, the dog's definitely trained to understand these directions.
Okay. So also, I got the vibe, kind of speaking to the other stuff, that, you know, a lot of it maybe is connected as far as trying to keep this character under control, you know? He introduced himself at the beginning as, like, one of the world's most authority on what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's got these robot guardians, you know, who are trying to keep him mundane. He's got a, you know, guidance counselor who, despite, like, admitted math genius, couldn't get him into any college, you know? You know, like, the lightning storm, coincidentally enough, happens right when he's about to connect with a character that is from the Beyonders that's going to get him out of this.
Yep.
You know? So, like, I feel like it's all somewhat connected. It's just maybe working at cross purposes when, you know, the power storm short circuits the robots.
Or is it just a little too convenient that he's got all these crazy conspiracy theories? That girl that he's chatting with online ends up being one of the Beyonders, and there's a massive power surge that cuts off all power. Maybe he's unconscious and he's imagining all these things.
Again, you know, I take things at face value when you show him.
Well, I think it would definitely be more interesting as a story if that weren't the case, right?
Yeah, I mean, my read just based on what it is that he's on these things, and, like, admittedly, the conversation before that had some weird things about it, but the next conversation seemed to be like, oh, hey, how's it going? Like, you want to talk about the Beyonders? No? And then it's like, oops, got cut off.
Yeah.
Like, they know what this kid's about. Like, I think the guidance counselor works for the government, and he's just, like, trying to shut the kid down and get him out of trouble. And did you notice on his wall he's got a I Want to Believe poster?
Oh, yeah. Of course he does. Dude, X-Files is classic, dude.
Right? So, you know, like, there's, like, characters within the FBI and the X-Files, like, at first Skinner, but then, I don't know, like, Krycek or whatever, who are...
Yep.
Just trying to shut him down, you know. It's like, that's the guidance counselor.
Yeah. You've got there's mention of this CIA guy Ivan Culliver who perfected mind control. That'd be like Cancer Man, you know. The girl that shows up, what's her name? Nariva, can't remember her name. Something with an N. She would be like Scully, kind of. He's a young Mulder. You know, even in the X-Files, some of the characters that you thought were kind of not important and maybe not involved in the conspiracy stuff ended up being very much involved in it, right? Like Mulder's dad or Scully's dad, Scully's sister, like all these characters ended up being part of this whole thing. So yeah, I definitely dug that stuff. One thing that's interesting too is this is being billed as a YA book. And the other book that we talked a little bit about being sort of YA was Betrothed. And in some ways there's similarities in that stuff, right? Because here you have the uncle who's kind of the guardian and keeping Jakey kind of living this mundane existence until he finds this big revelation that he's been right all along. And in Betrothed you had kind of the same thing, right? Because you had the aunt and uncle that were protecting the kids on Earth until they learned that, hey, like, you guys are gonna, you know, when you get married, you're gonna rule this empire. So I thought that was interesting. That seems like a pretty typical YA trope that I've seen a lot. And not just in these comics, like going back to movies that I've watched, you know, growing up in the 80s.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, it's natural, you know, when you have characters that are high school age, you know, that you kind of work a little bit of that into it. You know, it speaks to that experience. Mm-hmm. But I definitely think it's a, you know, very rich story. You know, like I'm very curious how much they really develop all of this historical intrigue. And I think probably you would agree one of the cooler aspects is that there's some kind of like cryptography mystery that's included in the story and a contest.
Yeah. So we're going to get to that in a second. I wanted to go back briefly to all the connections made at the beginning, because in my opinion, that's part of the way to solve this puzzle. And I tweeted out at Paul Jenkins right before we started recording, so I don't expect a reply tonight, but hopefully within the next day or so, I'll get a reply. Because when the book opens up, you have George Irvine, I think is his name, the first guy to climb Mount Everest, and he got lost. And there's a connection that comes back later on to George. You have this town in England called Avebury. And it's a town that's been built around this, like, Stonehenge-like monument. And I looked all these things up, by the way. All these things are real. Matter of fact, you can look up pictures of Avebury, and it's freaking awesome to look at. Cause you have this, like, henge, and just the town is built right inside it. It's crazy. From there, you move on to Ricky McCormick, who I wish Ronnie was here, cause I want to know if Ronnie knew about this guy. He died in St. Charles County, Missouri in 99. So, I mean, this is pretty recent, right? So I'm sure Ronnie knows about this. And that story is kind of interesting because the guy died and, nobody knows how he died. They just know he was murdered and he had some notes in his pocket that were written in ciphers and nobody has been able to decipher what those notes mean. You've got, a suggestion about the Baghdad batteries. That's what the clay pots are. Which nobody knows what they were used for. They just know that they were batteries because they were built just like we started building batteries before we actually had little tiny, you know, triple A's or whatever. Originally it was kind of done like this. It was a vessel and you had a metal and a conduit in between and you're able to whatever. I'm not going to explain how electricity works. So I thought that was interesting. And the connection to that was the Antikythera mechanism, which is found on a sunken ship. I can't remember where, but it's a Greek thing. And it's been speculated that it was kind of like an astrological computer used for navigation, but nobody really knows. And that thing's fascinated me for fucking forever, dude. When I think I first heard about it, watching Ripley's Believe It or Not, in like the late 80s. And, ever since then, I thought it was really fascinating. Then you've got a couple connections you already mentioned. One is, Piri Rice and the other one is, Zhenxi. Zhenxi being a, Chinese cartographer. He was, an admiral for the, Chinese Navy and apparently did a lot of, different expeditions around the world and created maps. And that's connected to Piri Rice, who was also an admiral for the Turkish, Navy and a cartographer. And supposedly, these two guys are the first to draw maps of the Americas in Antarctica. You know, like 100 years before Columbus got here. And I hadn't heard of Piri Rice before, but I had heard of Zhenxi because I have heard about these stone walls in California, And I was curious, since you live in California, if you had ever heard of these.
No, actually. I mean, that caught me by surprise. I'm in Southern California, so.
Okay.
I'll beg ignorance on that.
Yeah, I have seen video of these things. They look pretty much like you see in the picture. They're very short stone walls, kind of crudely built. But they're up in Northern California, and apparently there is evidence of like Chinese visitations to California. I guess they found like, pottery maybe or something. I don't know exactly what the thing is. But I thought that whole thing was really interesting how they made that connection. Then you've got a couple cipher things with Edward Elgar, who, from my understanding, was just crazy. And he kind of made this symphony based on some code that he had. I don't remember hearing the music, but I think this may also have been in Ripley's Believe It or Not, because it sounded vaguely familiar. And that ties into a couple other things. For example, the Voynich manuscript, which I would say maybe one of the most famous medieval ciphers, at least for people interested in that stuff like I am. And it's really weird. Like, some of it is kind of decipherable, but there's a lot of like weird plants and animals in there. There's recipes for things, but it's all written in code and nobody's really been able to decipher it. So there's different theories on what it could actually be. And then of course it all kind of ends with this Ivan Culliver, who I found no reference to. So I'm assuming this guy is made up. Or maybe he was real, but you can't find him because he was a covert CIA guy.
If we knew about mind control, like if it existed, maybe we would know about it. But yeah, to your point, you know, wait, you said it was the CIA that created it, right?
So that's what it says on here, the CIA operative.
So is that like MK Ultra type stuff?
Yeah.
And it's just like it's just maybe government secret, so they're not it's not on the internet. But that's what they're going for.
Dude, let me tell you, I'm glad you brought that up because I hope that they tackle MK Ultra in here. MK Ultra is one of the most fascinating things you could ever read. You can get into a gazillion different freaking rabbit holes by looking up MK Ultra. Like, there's even connections to, what's the drink the Kool-Aid guy?
Jim Jones?
Jim Jones. There's even like a theory that Jim Jones is a CIA guy. And the whole cult that he had in Guyana was like an experiment for MK Ultra. You can go into a gazillion rabbit hole. So I hope that MK Ultra is somehow a part of the story. Cause, I don't see that tackled very often. I've been reading The Invisibles by Grant Morrison. MK Ultra is a huge part of that book. And it's freaking fascinating. So I hope that's kind of discussed here in some way, shape or form. But, yeah, really, really interesting stuff. And, I love the crazy connections that are being made. Cause one thing about conspiracy theories is you can create a conspiracy theory based on a conspiracy theory and it'll make sense cause you have pre-existing evidence or quote unquote evidence. And I just think that's fascinating. I love the way that all that was tackled.
Yeah. Well, like just along those lines, you know, if it's like the X-Files, but if you took several weeks of the X-Files, you know, like a bunch of different cases, and they were all connected.
Yeah.
You know, it's like one leads to one leads to one. Seems to me that what we're looking at really overall with, like, all the cryptography speaks to, like, there being a message or something that people are trying to propagate into the future but keep secret.
And since you brought that up, we'll go back to your previous point that there is a secret message in this book, which I absolutely love that that's the case.
Drink more Ovaltine?
Is that what the secret message is?
I'm calling it right now. Or what is it? What's the number? Like 34? 42?
42. Yeah. So there is a secret code in this book. From what Paul Jenkins has been saying and what the final page of the book discusses is that, you can figure this code out. I started to right before we started recording the podcast. So I'm going to get to that in a second, but this is a 5-issue miniseries. When you read this book, if you notice on each and every single panel, there is a symbol on that panel. Somehow these symbols will form a code. That code will run through all 5 issues. Apparently there is a prize for the first 100 people that figure out this code. And all you need to do is when you figure it out, you email, what was it, like beyonders@gmail.com, I think it is. Yeah, beyonderscode@gmail.com. You email that email address, and if you are one of the 100 people that figure it out, you're going to get a giant prize. Apparently there's, I think there's multiple prizes and also a grand prize, if I read that correctly. I could be wrong though. No, yeah, that's right, because it says, each issue will contain clues, which when assembled will lead the lucky winners to an awesome prize. And then it also says at the end, trust us, it'll be worth it for the fun alone, but the grand prize is pretty valuable in its own right. I'm really curious to know what the prize is. Like, it could be the dumbest thing, dude. I remember in high, I don't want to talk about the story. Never mind. We're gonna skip that story.
It's a Baghdad battery.
I would love an original Baghdad battery. Give me that. So yeah, so I started looking at these, symbols. So I wrote all the symbols down. Some of them I immediately knew what they were because people that listen to other podcasts that I do know that I love languages. So I'm very familiar with a few different alphabets, and there's a few that I recognized immediately. So there's like, there's runes in here. There's some Arabic, symbols. There's Greek alphabet in here. I'm trying to figure out all of them. Cause some I wasn't quite sure what they were, and some I found that like right before we started recording, like one of them is, the Gothic alphabet. There's a lot of Gothic letters in it. There's some that are just symbols as well. So there's like a male symbol, a female symbol. There's I think it was a radioactive symbol in there as well. A couple other ones. And there's also numbers. There's also letters and numbers that have backgrounds, either in different colors or different shapes. So I'm very excited to spend some time with all of my available free time that I have all the time, right? Because obviously I have nothing better to do than to crack a code. But I'm gonna spend a little time this week and see if I can figure out some of this stuff. The ones that I immediately knew offhand, I went ahead and did a literal alphabet translation. And I shot Paul Jenkins a message because I'm curious, right? Like what, if there's some clues as to how this goes about. So like some I assumed based on the settings, right? So because Everest is in Tibet, I assumed some kind of Himalayan script. The Avery stuff, I assumed runes. You know, with the Baghdad battery, I assume Arabic, obviously Greek from the Antikythera mechanism. I looked up, different Arabic scripts for Piri Reis because he was Turkish. And I think I settled on like Ottoman script because it's about the right era. The Shang-Chi stuff is a little more difficult, because, you know, Chinese doesn't have an actual alphabet. It's, ideograms. So. Yeah. I started looking at some of those. I looked at some Japanese, syllabaries as well. So that might be the way that I go. Interestingly enough, Shang-Chi was Muslim. Anyways, so we'll see. I'm going to spend a little time this weekend, see if I can figure it out.
Yo, just along those lines, did you notice that the dudes who are breaking into the house at the end with guns, are speaking some weird language?
Yep.
You think that's just alien language, or you think that's like a real language?
Well, I assumed aliens because if you look right before they bust into the house, the storm's going on, and you see a picture of the house from the outside, and there's helicopters swirling around, but there's also large black cylinders, and I assumed the black cylinders were alien spaceships.
Got it. Yeah, a lot of language stuff going on.
Yep. So, with that said, you can assume I'm going to rate this a 5 out of 5 because I love this kind of stuff. And I know it's not for everybody. I know you and I very briefly talked before we started recording that it's not necessarily your thing. But I think it's fun. You know, it's something, an additional thing to look at. And I found myself reading this book several times because I kept on being distracted by the symbols. So I was like, screw it. I'm just going to write all the symbols down so I can just quit worrying about it. And then I read the book a couple more times because I kept on getting distracted. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. The art's fantastic, by the way. I think even better than when we had in Fujitsu.
Yeah, dude, I really wish you the best of luck for working on the code thing. Just to clarify, I just said that I am not good at you know, code deciphering. That's yes, just not. Yes. That's like banging my head against a brick wall. So, I'll leave that to you to report back. But I do like the story, you know, like I think it's pretty cool that you have all these like real historical nods in there, you know. I do sometimes just struggle with trying to keep straight like what is fact and what's fiction, but you know, I you know, definitely interested, and you know, I think it's about to get a lot crazier, so I'll go 4.5 out of 5.
Nice. All right, that's going to wrap up this discussion of this past week's books. Let's see. Next week, we have a plethora of books to talk about, Travis.
Oh, really?
A plethora. We have Clank Pillars number 3. We have Dark Ark number 10. We have Pestilence, A Story of Satan number 4. And Relay number 3.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a heavy week, yeah.
Heavy week. Last week, we had nothing. This week and next week, it's packed.
Let me ask you this, Martin.
Yes.
This is the last episode of the month, right?
Yep.
What's your book of the month, Aftershock book of the month for August?
Oh, man. You should have asked me beforehand so I could actually think about this for a minute.
I'm going to go first.
Go first, for sure.
Because obviously there's a lot of great stuff.
Yes.
But for me, I'm going to give the edge to Relay.
Mm.
Honorable mention for the one with the robots?
Volition.
Volition, yeah. That's my number 2.
Man, this is I got to tell you, we've been reading Aftershock for a long time. I've been reading Aftershock since pretty soon after they launched. I think they were out like 3 months. This may be the strongest month that they've ever had in terms of stories. I think in particular this month, I only didn't enjoy one book and the one, well, let me rephrase that. Enjoyed not as much as the rest because it was still a great issue. But I think there's a really solid lineup right now. Tough for me to figure out yet because a lot of these are number ones and, I don't like to make final judgments on just reading a first issue because a lot of can go wrong, past the first issue. But if I had to place them on a list right now, Hot Lunch Special was Book of the Week for me when it came out. And I don't know if any of the other Aftershock books were a Book of the Week for me in terms of my overall reading. So it's definitely up there. Volition I thought was a brilliant first issue, so that's very high up there as well. And I'm really loving this one too. But it's really hard, man. I think every single issue that came out in August, really, really strong.
I agree.
All right. I think that's going to wrap this up. What do you think? Are we done? I think we're done.
Yeah, let's do it.
You've been listening to the Aftershock Central Podcast with Travis and Martin. Travis is at The Great Magnet. I'm at Geekvine. If you want to get in touch with Ronnie and yell at him for being a slacker and not showing up to the podcast, you can find him at Rumbar316. I think that's it. We'll catch you next week. Beep, beep, beep.